Welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at you from Auckland, New Zealand, the city of sails, where I'm here for a few days having a very interesting experience. But I'm very excited now to welcome the most well-known guest I've ever had on my radio show, a truly legendary mind of the 20th and 21st century, Dr. Fritjof Capra. An Austrian-American, originally a theoretical physicist who's gone on to become, he'll have to tell you in his own words, but he's a systems thinker, a holistic philosopher, an environmental activist, and a very brilliant mind with a gift for clarity of expression. I first met him at the Esalen Institute in 1980, and we kept in touch for a while. And my friend Elizabeth Shapcott in Tasmania, a few weeks ago, I was interviewing her, and she mentioned Fritjof Capra and his book, The Turning Point, and what a huge influence that was on her. And here we are with Fritjof. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words. I really look forward to our conversation. It has been a long time. 1980 was a long time ago.
Oh, my God. Several incarnations of the universe ago. Yes. Do you remember meeting me? You wouldn't remember me, but I did a workshop with you at Esalen. I was there to do a workshop with John Lilly, and you did a weekend workshop that I did either right before or right after that. And we talked, and we kept in touch for a few years because you were interested in the dolphin communication work.
And, yeah, I remember that now.
And you had... You had just created the Elmwood Institute, and we sort of kept in touch, and I actually moved back east a few months later, and but I've followed your work, and I kind of lost touch with what you were doing for the past...
Talk about all of that.
Yes. Well, so for people that aren't familiar with you, tell us just a bit about yourself. You were... you're originally Austrian, and you were a theoretical physicist, but other than that, I don't really know very much.
That's right. Well, I grew up in Austria. My mother was a poet, and my father was a lawyer and an amateur philosopher. So he had a lot of philosophy books and talked about philosophy, the great German philosophers, but also about Buddhism and various other philosophies. So with my brother and I, my brother is 2 years younger and he's a filmmaker in Los Angeles, Bernd Capra. So when we grew up in Innsbruck in the Alps in Austria, there was always a lot of talk about literature, art, philosophy around the dinner table. I don't have any scientists in my family, but my mother was a writer, and so was my grandfather and her father. And so when I went to high school in Innsbruck, I had a very exciting mathematics teacher who really turned me on to mathematics and made me love mathematics. He was young and enthusiastic, and a few of my colleagues, a few of us boys, had a talent for mathematics, and he tutored us in addition to the math classes. And for example, he taught me calculus in high school, which was not taught at all at that time. We're talking about the 1950s now.
May I guess who this was? Was this somebody like Werner Heisenberg or Mandelbrot or somebody? No, I'm just kidding.
Not even famous, no. He was a mathematician. His name was Peter Lesky. He was Austrian and then worked in Germany at the University of Stuttgart and was a very well-recognized mathematician. But when I met him in the 1950s, he was teaching high school. I was maybe 16. So I was very excited about mathematics. And then I enrolled in the University of Innsbruck to study mathematics, with a minor in physics. And I'm telling you this story because it shows how important the influence of teachers is.
Yes.
When I entered university, I took my first calculus course, sort of calculus 101, and the teacher there was very bad, very boring, you know, really not exciting at all. And the physics teacher, a professor of theoretical physics, was very flamboyant, very exciting. So after the first semester, I switched from mathematics to physics. And that's how I became a physicist.
That is very interesting.
And so then I graduated. I did my graduate work in Vienna in quantum physics, and graduated from the University of Vienna, and then spent 20 years working in theoretical physics, theoretical high energy physics. And, after about 10 years, the next big point in my life was as a young student when I read a book by Werner Heisenberg. You mentioned Heisenberg. Founders of quantum physics, and the book is called Physics and Philosophy.
Yes. Is it true? He was a bit uncertain about it all, wasn't he?
Yes. He elevated that uncertainty to a principle. And so in this book, Heisenberg describes a big intellectual struggle that took place in the 1920s and 30s, when a handful of physicists saw themselves facing a totally new kind of reality, the reality of atomic and subatomic phenomena, and they had to change their language, their basic concepts, their whole way of thinking. And so that excited me very much, that philosophical aspect of science, of physics. And as a young student, I didn't understand much of the book, maybe not more than half, but the book stayed with me and accompanied me throughout my life. And Heisenberg was a strong influence on my whole way of thinking and my career. And I was fortunate to meet him much later in the 1970s. I had two very stimulating impactful meetings with Werner Heisenberg.
That's truly legendary. That is truly legendary.
Yeah.
And so is that that must have sowed the seeds for your work that went on to become the Tao of physics.
Well, you see, between my student years and the writing of the Tao of physics were the 1960s, and as you well remember, this was a magical time for all of us.
Yes.
In which there was an expansion of consciousness, both in the social realm, questioning authority of all kinds, all these 60s movements, and in the spiritual realm, in expanding consciousness toward mysticism, toward meditation, toward a different kind of awareness. And so I was very involved in that. And as soon as I began to study Eastern philosophy and began meditation and experimented with psychedelics, all that showed me a reality which showed surprising parallels to the reality described by Heisenberg in his book.
Yes.
So that's when I started making the connection.
That is so interesting. You anticipated my next question. I was going to ask if you had any experience with psychedelics, because LSD was actually legal there for a couple of years, and John Lilly had done it, and Timothy Leary. And I think it was a very, very powerful catalyst that opened a lot of doors.
Absolutely. I actually had my greatest experience with smoking marijuana, and we smoked a lot of grass, as it was called, in those days, and I had very deep experience, which then led me on to meditation and to a corresponding meditative experiences.
Yes, well, it's really all, I mean, you know, like marijuana, you're sort of communing with the plant kingdom in different ways, and I think that, you know, ultimately it's like all the different roads can lead to the same kind of transformations of consciousness, and I think it was kind of common wisdom that, you know, the psychedelics and molecules can take you somewhere really fast, but if you do it on your own, maybe slower, but you're in a greater control of what's going on.
And you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, I smoked marijuana pretty regularly from maybe 69 to maybe 75, you know. And then I left it, and now it's legal in California, but I don't smoke it. I haven't smoked a joint for, I don't know, 20 years or so.
Well, that's almost the same with me. I smoked up until about, oh, it's been 6 or 8 years ago. And even someone gave me some the other day, some really nice organic, but I just, you know, I've got it saving it to give to somebody. But I love, you know, the plant kingdom has so much to teach us.
So Jeff, let me tell you about the next crucial step in my life and in my career.
Yes.
And that is what I now call my epiphany on the beach. And this was in 1969 in California. One late summer morning, I was sitting on one of these beautiful California beaches, watching the surf roll in a slow rhythm, in meditation, no drugs, meditating on the beach. That was the big thing in those days.
Yes.
You had to meditate on the beach if you lived in California.
Absolutely.
So I was sitting there in meditation, trying to harmonize my breathing with the rhythm of the waves, when all of a sudden, I felt that my entire environment, the sand, the rocks, the air, the water, and my own body was engaged in a gigantic cosmic dance. And now, as a physicist, having by that time done several years of theoretical research, I knew that all the materials in my environment were made of atoms, they were vibrating, and the energy of the vibration is what we measure as heat. And then the atoms consisted of particles that were interacting with one another, creating and destroying other particles. I also knew that rays, so-called cosmic rays of high energy particles, constantly impinge on the atmosphere and create showers of reactions among subatomic particles. So all this was familiar to me from my physics research, but I knew it theoretically through mathematical equations, diagrams, and so on. Now this experience somehow came to life, and in meditation I felt this cosmic rhythm and I experienced it as a dance. And at that moment I realized that this is what the Hindus mean when they talk about Shiva Nataraja, the Lord of the dance, the cosmic dance of creation and destruction. And this really was the very beginning of my writing the Tao of Physics. I had recognized some parallels between Eastern mysticism and modern physics, but at that moment on the beach, I really experienced it, and that put me on the way to write my first book.
Wow, that is really, really fantastic. And what if there was a pod of dolphins out there beaming a telepathic transmission to you right during that time?
Who knows? So then I moved back to Europe and I spent 4 years in London.
Yes.
And that's when I wrote the Tao of Physics.
In London.
Now, I also want to say that when I decided to write this book, I was quite sure that these parallels between modern physics and Eastern mysticism would be common knowledge someday, and that if I didn't write the book, somebody else would.
Yes.
And there have been several books while I was writing the Tao of Physics. There have been two or three other books, but not as detailed and often not written by working physicists. So mine was really the first full comprehensive exploration of these parallels. And then after publication of the book, there have been several generations of similar books about science and mysticism.
Yes, well, I consider your work to be the vanguard paradigm shift. I mean, it was like you were it was like the new dreaming of the synthesis of the scientific worldview and the Eastern philosophical traditions. And it was, you know, probably a lot of people had awareness along that line, but...
And the reason, because a lot of people sensed it themselves, not only scientists, but people from all kinds of walks of life, that was the reason why the book was so successful. So the Tao of Physics was published in 1975 and immediately found a large readership. And as a consequence, I got invited to a lot of conferences and symposia to speak about it. And I spoke to all kinds of professional organizations, first, interestingly, to artists.
Yes.
The very first lecture I gave on the Tao of Physics, before the book was even published, was at the Chelsea School of Art in London, an art school. And then there was another one called Architectural Association, School for Architects.
Yes.
That was my second big lecture. So I spoke to all kinds of people, like, you know, doctors, nurses, anthropologists, architects, psychologists, economists. And now something interesting happened. Very often when I discussed that paradigm shift in physics from a mechanistic to a holistic worldview, they said to me, guess what? Something like this is happening in my discipline too. So I became interested in biology, in medicine, in psychology, in economics, and began to study the same kind of paradigm shift in these other fields. And that eventually led me to write my second book, The Turning Point, which you mentioned already.
Absolutely. You were articulating sort of a transformative evolutionary process that was underway, and you were able to describe it in a way that sort of helped make it more conscious to everybody. And I can see, as I remember, the turning point where you sort of took a lot of the insights of connectedness and the differences of the two worldviews explaining the same things in different ways. You applied this new sort of vision or perception of reality to the real world and started looking at real world problems. And you know what? The main thing I remember is you described what you called the Newtonian Cartesian paradigm.
That's right. But something very interesting happened, Jeff, while I was writing the book. Well, let me tell you that before I wrote The Turning Point, I wrote a number of articles. So between 1975 and 1980, say, I wrote a number of articles about the paradigm shift in various fields. And the basic idea was that the sciences had taken the Newtonian physics as their model, say biology, medicine, economics, psychology, psychoanalysis. Physics was always presented as the queen of the sciences, and they were talking about Newtonian physics. And so in my articles I argued, now that we know the limitations of Newtonian physics, and now we have the new quantum physics and relativity theory, so maybe these could be now models for a new medicine, a new psychology, and so on. And that was a fallacy, that argument. And I recognized that while I was writing The Turning Point. And the reason it is a fallacy is that when you talk about economics or biology or psychology, you're talking about life. You're talking about living systems.
Yes.
People, animals, plants, ecosystems, social systems, and so on. And physics has nothing to say about life. So physics cannot be a model for these living systems. On a search to find a conceptual framework that would allow me to discuss life in its multiple manifestations. And that was a 30-year-long search that began with The Turning Point around 1980. So that is the reason why around 1985 I left physics I stopped my active research in physics and turned toward the life sciences, investigating the paradigm shift in these various life sciences and putting together a conceptual framework which I called, already in the turning point, I called it the systems view of life.
Yes, that is...
And that expression has stayed with me until now, and my last book actually is a textbook, which is called The Systems View of Life.
Really?
And it's published by Cambridge University Press, and it's co-authored by a friend of mine, an Italian biochemist, Pierluigi Luisi. And we call it The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision. And that, for me, is a synthesis of my whole work over the last 30 years.
Wow, that is so fantastic. And when I saw, there's a photo of you on your website that shows your bookshelf behind you, and it looks like you've got many, 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 many books now, most of which I've never heard of. And but that's so cool that you've almost come full circle, you know, at the next turn of the spiral.
You could say that the systems view of life is the 21st century version of the turning point.
Wow.
Because, you see, in 1980, there is actually a section of the book, The Turning Point, which is called The Systems View of Life. But at that time, that was not a theory, not even the outlines of a theory. I had come across various ideas, but they were not a coherent framework.
Yes.
And I just began to put these together, and it took another 30 years for the full synthesis to be completed.
Well, it's very synchronistic and serendipitous that Isabel made me think of you, and that we're doing this dialogue now at this point, 30 years after that I met you and first learned of your work. And it's at this, it's very, very interesting how all this kind of it's all happening. Now, there's a name, another name that I remember who was a very influential person who I believe that you worked with was Ilya Prigozhin.
Prigozhin,
yes. The self-organizing systems.
That's right. Well, it's, to put this into a nutshell,
yes,
the whole synthesis.
Okay? Yes.
In order to talk about life in its various manifestations, we can start with biology, and we can just ask the age-old question, what is life? What's the nature of life? And in a scientific language, I would say, what's the difference between, say, a rock and a plant? What are the essential characteristics that a plant has and a rock does not? And can you sort of put this in one sentence, you know? What defines biological life? And I learned this from one of my other great heroes, Lynn Margulis.
Yes.
The microbiologist. And she points out that the essential characteristic of life is metabolism. And what we mean by metabolism is a constant flow of energy and matter through a network of chemical processes that allows a living organism to continually maintain itself, repair itself, and perpetuate itself, reproduce itself, perpetuate itself.
Yes.
So that's what's known as metabolism. And Lynn Margulis used to say, if it metabolizes, it's alive. If it doesn't metabolize, it's not alive.
Well, now, how about crystals? Aren't they kind of halfway in between there?
They are kind of halfway, but they do not metabolize because they do not have this continuous flow of energy and matter that they need for their existence.
Yes, and
if
you
put a crystal into a vacuum,
yes,
for a week, and then take it out, it's still the same crystal.
Yes, it's like the metabolism is the exchange of energy information between the organism and its environment.
If you put a rabbit or a butterfly into a vacuum for a week, even for, a few minutes, it will die. And so that's the difference. Living organisms need a continuous exchange of energy and matter with the environment. So when you look at this definition of metabolism, there are two aspects to it. There's the aspect of networks, which is a very important part of the systems view of life. You could say that this whole paradigm shift is really a shift from seeing the world as a machine to seeing it as a network. That shift from the machine to the network is the very essence of it.
Well, now, would you say that the network could also be looked at as a very complex organism itself, a sort of a meta-organism?
Well, the network is not all there is to the organism, but the network is the basic pattern of organization.
Yes.
Relationships of the parts organize themselves in network fashion.
Yes, well, look, let me ask you this. Can you draw a distinction or a parallel between system, network, and field? They're kind of similar, but not exactly the same.
Yeah, but the field is really something different, because the field has to do with a condition of space.
Okay.
Where objects in that space feel a certain kind of force, like a gravitational field or an electromagnetic field.
Yes.
It's really a different concept. It's also used in biology in terms of morphogenetic fields, but that's an approximation, a theoretical concept. It's quite different from a metabolic network.
Yes.
But let me go on. I haven't finished with metabolism.
Yes.
Give me a couple more minutes.
Absolutely.
So the network aspect is one aspect of metabolism. The other aspect is the flow aspect, this continual flow of energy and matter through the network. And when I began to investigate this and started working on a synthesis, I realized something very strange. I realized that there were people in this new paradigm who were working with networks, and there were people who were working with flows. Theorists, scientists.
Yes.
And they didn't talk to each other. Although metabolism is defined as a flow of energy through a network, you need both. So, and I'm coming back to Prigozhin, Ilya Prigozhin, Nobel laureate, with his so-called theory of dissipative structures, studied the flows of energy and matter through living systems. Umberto Maturana is another big scientist in Chile.
Yes.
Who is still alive, who is almost 90 now. I think he's going to be 90 this year.
I've heard his name.
And so he defines life as self-organizing and self-generating networks. And what I realized was that these two camps, if you wish, the network camp and the flow camp, the Maturana camp and the Prigozhin camp, didn't communicate with one another. And so my synthesis is really to put together the network perspective with the flow perspective.
So you're functioning as a sort of corpus callosum connecting the two two hemispheres. You're the capra callosum.
Yeah. To put it at the personal level, Maturana worked with a colleague called Varela, Francisco Varela.
Yeah, these are systems guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And they put together a theory of networks, which is known as autopoiesis.
Ah.
And I know them. I knew them both. I still see Maturana, but I knew Varela much better.
Yes.
I saw him much more often and worked with him. And so let me tell you a story. Prigozhin has this idea of a structure which has energy and matter flowing through it continuously. and yet remaining stable, like a water vortex, for instance.
Yes.
Water flows through it continuously, and yet that funnel remains relatively stable.
It's the pattern.
Right. And so Prigozhin calls this a dissipative structure. And all living systems are dissipative structures, okay? So one day I asked Francisco Varela, in your view, are all the living systems dissipative structures? And he said, yes, of course, they have to be. And so I said, why don't you say so in your books and papers? And he said, oh, well, that's Prigozhin, you know, that's his stuff, we don't do that. So then I asked Prigozhin the same question, you know? I said, what do you think of Maturana and his theory of autopoiesis? And Prigozhin said to me, oh, you know, Maturana, I can never understand him. Why does he call it a dissipative structure? You know? So there was absolutely no communication between them.
But they're really talking about the same thing.
Yeah, and now there is, you know, different aspects of the same phenomenon. But, and I think that's what I achieved, to put those two together in my synthesis.
Well, see, we'll have to make up a concept for this process that you are somehow magically able to achieve. So it's almost like a form of alchemy, an involuntary...
It may seem magic, but it was 30 years of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so a lot of thinking went into it, a lot of discussions, and I not only synthesized the network and the flow aspect in biology, but then I extended it to the social domain, where we also talk about networks, where we talk about networks of communication, where we talk about the generation of ideas, of values, of culture, and so on.
Yes. Well, you're anticipating something I wanted to ask you about in a minute, which is about the real-world application of these insights and stuff. But I wanted to go back just for a second and ask you a couple of things. Would you say that the dissipative structures, what's the relationship between that and what we call in thermodynamics entropy, or negentropy would be sort of like what? Would you say that life is negentropic?
Yes, absolutely. And what happens, this is actually maybe even the biggest achievement of Prigozhin. And although there are many of his achievements, but that's certainly a big one to resolve that problem. Just for those of our listeners who are not so familiar with these concepts, the concept of entropy was formulated in thermodynamics, and it is a measure of disorder. And there is something called the second law of thermodynamics that says when you have a closed physical system, the system will spontaneously proceed from order to disorder. So as you go on in time, there will be more and more disorder. And for example, you can take, you know, one good example that is often used in textbooks is if you have a bag of black gravel and a bag of white gravel, and you put them together, and the gravel stands for molecules, you know. That happens also in thermodynamics with molecules. But if you have these little stones, and you put them in a single bag, and shake it, and mix it, then the longer you shake it, the grayer will the mixture become. The more will the white and the black be mixed. It could happen that, theoretically, that after an hour of shaking, all the black ones will go to one side and the white ones to the other side, but they don't. You know, disorder in terms of this mixture is continuing to increase. And so physicists predicted in the 19th century that this is true for the whole world, and the whole world, working like a machine, as they thought in those days, will eventually run down and will have maximum disorder, everything will die.
Well, does that maximum disorder translate into a complete, an absolute homogeneity of the distribution of everything?
Yes.
And so there would be no information left at all, right?
Yeah, no information, no movement, no life, everything is dead. Well, so physicists in the 19th century had a theory of evolution which said that the world evolves from order to disorder. Well, biologists following Darwin and Lamarck and others at the same time had the opposite theory. They say, no, everything evolves, life evolves to greater and greater order. And so this was a contrast, a contradiction, which was unresolved and remained unresolved until Prigogine solved it. And what Prigogine showed with a mathematical theory is that what actually happens, that in this whole world, say the planet Earth or the universe, there are islands of order where order increases and they are in a sea of disorder. So while the order increases, the disorder is emitted, is dissipated, and the environment has greater disorder, but the island has greater order. And so Prigogine could unify those and say the second law of thermodynamics is still valid. Overall, the disorder increases, but it doesn't increase uniformly. There are islands of order in a sea of disorder.
Wow.
That was his big achievement.
That's reckoning each, what you might call each holon, is like a vortex of dissipative. Would you say that in the quantum worldview that a closed system really does not exist?
That's right, and that was the fallacy. You're quite right, Jeff. The fallacy of the 19th century scientists was to look at closed system. And life, as I said before, because of metabolism, the very definition of life, is never a closed system. It's always open to flows of energy and matter.
Yes. Well, now let me go to another question I wanted to ask you about. I think you and I both are lovers of life and nature and environmental activists, and we might not even get to a lot of that in this interview, but I wanted to ask you, is it valid or possible to look at, I call her Mother Earth, because I really feel a very personal relationship with the planetary being that allows us to exist. And if you look at a planet as an organism, and she would have metabolic processes, right? The metabolism of a planet. And I think for us to try to understand that, and that's not just limited to the Earth. Her environment is like the heliocosm, all the connections with the planets and the sun and the stars and the comets and the asteroids and everything. And this is our cosmic context that we've been in ever since forever.
Yeah. And that is, in scientific terms, that's the famous Gaia theory.
Yes.
By James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, which says the Earth, the planet Earth, is indeed a living system. It metabolizes. Energy comes in from the sun, goes through a network of chemical reactions, including photosynthesis and including especially a global network of bacteria, which regulates the atmosphere and oceans of the Earth, the temperature and so on, so as to make life possible. And then at the end of it, the dissipated energy is emitted into the cosmic environment, into the planetary environment. The planet Earth is indeed a living system showing all these characteristics.
Now, let me ask you this. I mentioned in 1986, I went from California with a group of people, and we went to a place called Big Mountain. It was on the border of the Hopi and Navajo Reservation, and we were there as a support group to support these indigenous elders who were, there was this company called Peabody Coal, And they were going to forcibly relocate these indigenous people so that they could continue to strip mine this land called the Grant Mineral Belt, where they had a lot of shale and coal and uranium. And we were up there. I was learning about the Hopi prophecy and their concept of Koyaanisqatsi. And I met Thomas Banyakya, the elder, and he was talking to us, telling us about the ancient Hopi prophecy. And one of them was an admonition that they believed that we should never have dug anything out of the earth, like mining. And the prophecy was, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And I was standing on the land where I believe they said that some of the uranium for the first atomic bombs was mined from there and assembled just down the hill at Los Alamos. And when we came down to Flagstaff later that week, I saw the largest newspaper headline that I'd ever seen, and it was the Chernobyl meltdown happened. I was up there learning about this, and this really blew my mind. And I went like, but look. But doesn't it all kind of like make sense? We dug out the uranium and we created the atomic bomb ultimately. Yeah. And today happens to be the 74th anniversary of Hiroshima. So how did all this happen?
Yeah, well, it happened. It's a legacy of the mechanistic worldview, seeing the world, including the planet, as you say, Mother Earth, not as a living being, but as a machine that can be exploited, and different parts can be exploited. Now, I don't go as far as to say we should not dig anything out of the earth.
Yes.
Because if you go to this extreme, then you would say, what about carrots and potatoes? Don't you want to dig those out of the earth?
Yes.
So, but we have to do it sustainably.
Yes.
You know, and not fall into this fallacy of believing there's unlimited growth.
Yes.
You know, economic growth, technological growth, and so on. That's the key point.
Yes. Did you?
Let me mention something here. And you have started talking. You started talking about this several times, about practical applications.
Yes.
And in personal terms, I mentioned a little while ago that I was very much influenced by the 60s, and the 1960s, in my view, were characterized by an expansion of consciousness in two directions, toward the transpersonal, spiritual direction, and in the social, political direction. And I was affected by both. So the social and political implications of the new paradigm were always in my mind. And already, you know, in the Turning Point, I talked about, I have several chapters about this. I have strong arguments against nuclear power, for instance, in that book. And that has continued. And in my last book, in the textbook, The Systems View of Life, about half of the book is theory and half of the book is practical applications. And my main message about practical applications of the systems view of life is that when you look at the major problems of our time, energy, environment, economic inequality, migration, violence and war, then you can see that none of these problems can be solved in isolation. They're all interconnected and interdependent. We call those systemic problems. They're problems of the system as a whole, and they need systemic solutions. And so I go at great length to discuss and profile systemic solutions that exist today and need to be applied.
Yes. Well, do you think that if people were somehow able to recreate the experience that you had on the beach and actually not just have these as ideas in their brain, but to physically feel with their whole fully advanced human biotechnology organism that we are, to actually feel and have experience similar to what you had. And so to actually feel our connection with Mother Earth and our family of life, and to develop and nurture a sense of love for all the other fellow beings and the forces of nature and stuff that we're a part of. And so that this becomes a tangible living experience rather than sort of an academic or a purely cognitive aspect.
Right. Certainly the experience of nature and spending time with nature is extremely important. But another important thing is community, human community.
Yes.
You know, to create and nurture communities and to experience life in a communal setting. That's very powerful too.
Yes. Well, do you sometimes feel that capitalism in the forms that it's gone to is kind of opposed to community?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the very antithesis of community. And I tell you why. The simplest way of seeing this is that capitalism in its current form subscribes to this crazy idea of indefinite growth.
Which Edward Abbey said that growth for its own sake is the ideology of the cancer cell.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So in order to promote this perpetual growth, the corporations of this world, the businesses, want us to continually consume their products. Not only continually consume them, but increase our consumption so that, you know, the GDP can continually increase.
Yes.
And so they do this by barraging us with advertising that tell us you will be happy only if you buy this product, right?
Yes.
Now, the best antidote, the most powerful antidote to that is to find happiness not in buying products, but in human relationships, in friendships, in love, in mutual support, in compassion. In other words, in community.
Yes.
So community is the most powerful dote to this crazy idea of perpetual economic growth.
Yes.
Why community is so important.
Another big, I'm always bringing up the concept that in true community living, of whom I use the example of the indigenous people of Australia, as they were able to live for 100,000 years or more in a harmonious, steady state way of beautiful, highly spiritual connection with life until it was disrupted by European invasion. But sharing. People don't, in a community, people don't have to sell stuff. You can just share and give, and everybody doesn't have to own their own of everything.
Right.
You know?
And the other reason, Jeff, why community is so important today is that the great challenge of our time is to live sustainably, right? To live in such a way that our way of life does not interfere with nature's inherent ability to sustain life.
Yes.
And in order to do so, we need to understand first, how does nature sustain life? How do ecosystems sustain life? And the one sentence, the one word answer is community, because ecosystems are ecological communities of plants, animals, microorganisms that have developed certain principles of organization that have sustained life for over 3 billion years.
Well, would you say that the concept of balance is important? Because as they say, koinoskatsi, it means life out of balance, and it's everything's kind of got out of balance, and that relates to an insight that Jonas Salk had that I'll share with you in a second. But the whole thing of, and the military, the existence of the whole giant military industrial juggernaut, and that's like a whole, it's so, when you really start looking into it, it's so much vaster than most people even realize, the amount of resources and money and energy for weapons of destruction. And it's like this parasite sucking off all the vitality of the planet.
Absolutely. And then you would ask, why do they do this? And ultimately they do it to sell weapons.
Absolutely.
It's a business plan.
Absolutely. But even if the weapons don't, even if they aren't used, they're exerting a very much of a death creating field of influence just by their existence, especially with the new generation of all the microwave stuff and the undersea warfare. I mean, the more you look into this, it's unbelievable. We're saturating the earth with all these deadly energies. And
let me come back to something more positive. That's not military industrial complex. But let me say a third thing about community.
Yes.
I mentioned that community is so important to counteract the advertising of global capitalism, and it's so important for sustainability because life sustains itself by creating and nurturing communities. But there's a third aspect why community is so important, and that's the idea of a learning community. That what we need today is not just acquire more knowledge, but we need transformative learning. A kind of learning that really changes our values, our ways of life, our ethics. And I have taught a lot of courses, given lectures and seminars, and I've experienced over the years that the most powerful and most effective way of transformative learning is in a learning community. When you experience new concepts together and discuss together how this changes your life and share experiences and testimonials together with sharing knowledge and information, that's very powerful. And that's what I'm trying to do now with my online course. You see, I have this, I wrote this textbook, and then I'm teaching the course of the Systems View of Life as an online course.
Yes.
And I have done this now for over 3 years, and I have a network of over 1,000 people around the world, including people in Auckland, where you are right now, and in over 60 countries around the world who have taken this course and form a learning community, a learning network.
And so when they take this course, do people then become an active part of this network?
Absolutely. So the course itself, and by the way, its official title is The Systems View of Life, but for PR reason, it's simply called Capra Course. And so that's the website, capracourse.net. And it consists of 12 lectures, which are pre-recorded, 40-minute lectures. And when you take the course, you take one lecture a week, and you can listen to it whenever you want to and however often you want to. And then there's a discussion forum where you can post comments and ask questions online. And during the whole 12 weeks of the course, I participate in this discussion forum every day. So I'm online with the course participants from around the world every day.
Yes. Do you have sort of a group chat where you'd have several people talking at the same time?
We have that too, but that is more difficult because of the time difference, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
So what we do is, in the course itself, people post things in a discussion forum.
Yes.
And then, you know, I would see it several hours later, or even sometimes a day later because of the time difference.
Yes.
But once you have taken the course, once you are part of the alumni network, then we have Zoom meetings with the Zoom platform where we can have a meeting from about 50 people around the world, you know, chatting.
Yes.
And that's very exciting.
It's like
many of those.
It's like a cross-pollination in real time, a cognitive cross-pollination. I thought of something, transformative learning community. That can be what TLC stands for now. Instead of tender loving care, you've got some TLC. Hey, look, Fritjof, we've only got a couple of minutes left in this first hour, but there's two things that I wanted to ask you about that relate. And one of them is this just ties back to if you don't mind me asking this, because you're Austrian, did you know an artist architect named Friedrich Hundertwasser?
I didn't, but my brother was friends with him. He knew him quite well, and and I admire his work very much.
Well, did you know that he lived the last 20 years of his life north of Auckland here?
Oh, really?
Yes. In fact, when I first came here in 2000, I was going to go and try to meet him because I really loved his work. And he actually passed away that week because he was going to visit Australia. But he's one of my heroes. And also, I wanted to just ask you, but because of the whole weird thing of and maybe this is something we can talk about in another subsequent interview, which I would be extraordinarily honored if we were able to do this again sometime. But there's this thing that which I think of as more of a socio-political phenomenon, much more that than an atmospheric phenomenon. They call it climate change. And there's a lot of confusion in the people that don't really have much scientific knowledge. And people have been led to believe that carbon dioxide is some kind of evil toxin. And I wanted you, as a physicist and a scientist, to just explain to people why plutonium is far more dangerous than carbon dioxide.
This would take quite a while, and maybe we really have to wait for another conversation.
Yes.
But the two are very different. One, plutonium is radioactive and stays radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years, and radioactivity destroys living cells and therefore is a great danger. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a shield in the so-called greenhouse effect that doesn't let the temperature out of the atmosphere and keeps it in the atmosphere and therefore heats up the atmosphere, which leads to global warming and the whole climate catastrophe that we're witnessing now. This is very well researched now, and I'd be happy to talk to you in detail some other time. But let me also say, I have a long section on climate change in my textbook, The Systems View of Life, where I go into all of these details.
Very interesting. But to me, it's the most important thing about carbon dioxide is that carbon dioxide is like the oxygen of the plant kingdom.
Yes, I mean, it's part of photosynthesis.
Yes.
Plants take in carbon dioxide. And for this very reason, when you realize that we need to draw down CO2 from the atmosphere, the only known and most effective way is through the photosynthesis of plants. Therefore, in order to diminish the excess carbon dioxide, the best way to do it is organic agriculture and planting trees.
Yes, I some of my best friends are trees.
Yeah. All right.
Well, look, Fridtjof Capra, thank you so much. And man, so what will you do? You do a lot of traveling?
Well, less so now because I teach my Capra course. The next course starts on the 25th of September.
Okay.
I will actually go to Europe in September, but I travel much less and I can do it at home.
Yes. Well, have you been down to Australia and New Zealand?
No, I haven't.
Would you like to?
Well, sometime, especially in January, because I'm a huge tennis fan.
Are you?
I would love to go to Melbourne in January to see the Australian Open.
At the Rod Laver Stadium.
Absolutely.
That is so cool. Well, Matt, I can't tell you how great it is to be in touch with you again, and thank you for this time. And I'm going to make a couple of painted rocks, and send for you and your wonderful assistant, Joan.
Thank you.
She's really good.
So
yes, and maybe we'll meet in person one day.
But, and until the next time.
Yes, and I'll be in touch, and maybe we can do this again sometime soon.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.